Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Lipke, and with me is Alex Bowden.
Hello.
We are covering historical Ashes series to find out which nation is more ridiculous at cricket. Is it England or Australia? And the series we've been covering this time around, as we head into the very last test of that series, is the 1981 Ashes.
Yes, the sixth and final test, long series this one. So what we do is we go through one test each episode, picking out the most ridiculous moments delivered by each side. I pick out England's, Dan picks out Australia's, and then we decide on a top three, and those moments get 3 points, 2 points, and 1 point, and whichever side earns most points wins that ridiculous test match. The ridiculous series score going into this sixth and final test is 2-1 to England after Australia took the fifth test to keep the series alive. Ian Botham and Chris Tavares' extraordinarily extreme rabbit and hare partnership was, we felt, less ridiculous than Kim Hughes not yet having learned how to pronounce Botham's name, to quote him. Hughes, yeah, I think he still does favour Botham. I've heard interviews with him since. I think he's sticking with that.
Lovely. Yeah, never change, Kim.
The final point was taken by Mike Whitney, barely even a first-class cricketer, and called up from Fleetwood via Gloucestershire to just snatch a point for the Aussie there. Dan will now tell us how the sixth test played out.
All right, so England won the toss and they elected to bowl first. And that decision seemed less than wise because Australia put on their first century opening partnership in 4.5 years. But Ian Botham suddenly started taking wickets, as he'd done so often. He finished with 6 for 125 as Australia ended on 352 all out. Alan Border finished on 106 not out. The England innings was eerily similar to the Australian one. Plenty of runs at the top of the order, including a Jeff Boycott century, but it also petered out to a total of 314, and that was thanks primarily to Dennis Lilly's 7 for 89, which meant that Australia spent the fourth day extending their lead to 388, with debutant Dirk Wellham also reaching triple figures. England appeared in trouble on the final day at 144 for 6, but wicketkeeper Alan Knott and captain Mike Brearley survived until stumps to secure a draw and ensure that England won the series 3-1.
My first nomination is Booze Without Boundaries, which I've just realised kind of sounds like a drinking competition, but it's not. It's not drinking, yes. Booze. It's the audible kind. Booze of disapproval.
B-double-O-S.
B-double-O-S. If I can just leap forward in time to set this one up, I remember when Kevin Peterson was first about to come into England's test team in sort of 2004, 2005. I think he played a few one days in 2004. And back then there was a lot of excited talk among fans about the prospect of future partnerships with Andrew Flintoff and just all the sixes that would be raining down on us. It didn't especially pan out, actually. They never really batted very well together, but you can see why the idea of it was exciting. And I mention this because what we got in this match in 1981 was the exact opposite of that. Jeff Boycott and Chris Tavares together at last. And it went pretty much exactly as you'd expect it would. And the crowd were exactly as happy as you would expect they would be about that. And we know this because you can hear it on the highlights. The match situation, it was in the first innings, England were one wicket down responding to that 352 from Australia. So it wasn't like Boycott and Tavares were like passively frittering away a position of dominance or anything like that. They were trying to set things up, but even so, the crowd was sufficiently fed up that they were making their feelings known. And it was one of those periods of play that's sort of like so significant within the action that it actually makes the highlights. They picked out a few deliveries where there were slow hand claps and jeering from the crowd. But the real cherry on the cake here is that we saw how Tavares responded to this, and he responded by just continuing to block the shit out of it.
Yes, it was great stuff from Tavares. I just felt that there was something very, very lovely about a home crowd booing their own batter for scoring too slowly, and him just going, fuck it, I don't care. I'm just going to score as slowly as I feel like because I'm Chris Tavares, and that is what I will do.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing you imagine seeing opposition fans booing, and then yes, you really dig in as a tourist and you get really insular about it. But this was the England team sort of against their own fans. Boycott and Tavares were at the crease together for a very, what I imagine was a very long 2 hours. Well, it was a bit more than 2 hours, but probably felt like an eternity, during which yes, Tavares made 24. And he'd done much the same thing in the previous test. In fact, I think he batted even slower. But on that occasion, he'd mostly done it with Ian Botham, who scored at more than a run a ball, which obviously makes the approach a lot more palatable.
I mean, it's the average scoring rate is fine in that situation.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Whereas this time, he batted the exact same way, only in partnership with Jeffrey Boycott, which is, well, yeah, less delicious. Boycott went on to 100, but it took him over 7 hours of batting and included a grand total of 3 boundaries. But not only that, his first boundary came when he was on 72. So you can imagine, you know, most like a good chunk of that was spent in partnership with Chris Tavares. Imagine being in the stands for that. You can only imagine what it must have been like. And I think it sort of reached a particularly acute point like late on the second day where they were obviously just playing for stumps. I suspect that's when the booing was. So that's my nomination, really. It's just the idea of Boycott and Tavares batting together and people having to watch that.
Yeah, that's a pretty grim situation, I think. The fact that Boycott seemed inspired by Tavares' example and thought, yeah, I should be more like you. And it's just like, no. I mean, in exactly the same way that Tavares was not inspired by both of them in the previous test.
Yeah, I think, like you say, it's sort of you sometimes have these contrasting, like they often said that about Peterson and Flintoff, that they would just sort of drag each other upwards into irresponsibility. You know, it would like, they would get giddy and lose their heads. Whereas if you've got sort of polar opposites, you bring them towards a sort of happy medium almost. Whereas this, they were just sinking into a non-event.
All right, my first nomination is Alan Border batting with a broken hand. So this one actually, it kind of segues from the previous test because while Border was fielding during England's second innings in the previous test, he apparently broke his hand.
Yeah, I think he was taking a slip catch. There was one bit on the highlights where I spotted it. Like, he actually took the catch, but he was doing that. Oh, it caught me a bit funnily looking at his hand thing afterwards. So I don't know, because he just carried on playing after that as well. As this nomination is really, but I think it was done.
Yeah, so he injured his hand to some degree that was apparently reasonably serious, but it didn't seem to hinder Border, because as you may recall from the previous episode, he ended up scoring 123 not out in an otherwise doomed run chase. But despite that, you know, the reports of a broken hand suggested to me that he might miss the sixth test, and I thought, oh, well, that's a shame, but, you know, got to see 5 tests of Alan Border, that's all well and good. And then I remembered that, wait a second, I know that Border famously played almost his entire 156 career tests in one lengthy consecutive streak. I think it was 153 in a row that he played. And basic mathematics suggests he can't play five tests and then miss one, if that's the case. So it turns out he did not miss the sixth test. He showed up with his still busted hand and he showed up to play. He made scores of 106 not out in the first innings and then 84 in the second innings, which meant that he made 313 runs from the time he broke his hand to his next dismissal. And I think that's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, 313 runs over two tests. And I looked this up and I was sort of like picked it out as something that was remarkable anyway. 15 hours of batting without being dismissed. And I'd kind of forgotten he had a broken hand for all of this.
Yeah, so he got some assistance. He was helped to his 50 by, again, it's something we saw in the previous test, kids interrupting the fielders on the way to the boundary. So he played a lovely shot. And then before it got anywhere near the boundary, 1,000 kids raced onto the pitch and prevented the fielder from stopping it.
Yeah, really unimpressed Richie. Was that what you were about to say?
Yeah, he wasn't happy, was Richie. I love it when Richie gets shitty about something. He got very, very shitty about these young kids. Basically, yes, I think young kids of today running onto the pitch. Shocking. But the other thing that helped Alan Border, of course, the fact that he batted all the way through and was not out meant that he did have to bat with the tail. And Australia had a spectacular tail in this particular test because Terry Alderman was not the number 11, which is always a sign that something very, very bad is happening, because Mike Whitney came in after Terry Alderman. And despite this, Border managed to farm the strike and he moved from about 80 to a century, mostly with Whitney just hanging around at the other end. And then once he got the milestone, he gave Mike Whitney a lovely little bum pat to say, thank you for helping me get there. It was nice stuff.
Just on the strike farming, I noticed that, you know, like you say, 9 wickets down, Border's just trying to keep the strike. And this strikes me as a very 1980s thing, but he at one point he kept the strike with a 3. You're typically trying to save singles, aren't you? But Border had sort of found a way of nicking the strike, which is, there were quite a lot of threes in this series, and no one really hits threes in England anymore. The grounds, I don't know, you see it a bit in Australia.
They've got big bats and small grounds.
Yeah.
I hope Boycott was hitting, we know he didn't hit a boundary, I hope he was hitting plenty of threes at least. Please tell me he was hitting threes.
Threes are more interesting, I would argue. Like one of the more, probably these days, more interesting than a four. They should like take fours off the scorecard. No one gives a toss about fours. Yeah. Put threes on there. I want to see how many threes you're hitting and all run fours. Yep. I really want to hear about those. And if fives, if there's a five on
fives
there,
and sevens.
That's the immediately the thing that I want to know about in that test match, if there's a five or a seven.
But once Border got to his ton, as I mentioned, Whitney got a bum pat. And then Whitney was so excited about this that he thrashed one through the covers off both of them for four. And that was kind of a big moment because it was his first test run because he hadn't made any runs in the previous test. And it also turned out that four was his highest first class score, which I thought was spectacular. And so apparently did Kim Hughes, because in the second innings, Mike Whitney was promoted to bat above Terry Alderman. Presumably based on that one scoring shot.
That's really marvellous. Like on the strength of that. So on the strength of that one shot in that innings, he first of all attained his highest first class score. And that score, that one shot score, was sufficient for him to be seen as a better bat than Terry Alderman.
I think that's correct.
In the second is he made a duck and Hughes just declared before Alderman could bat. That's so just as a matter of things.
Oh, clearly if Mike Whitney can't score a run, what hope does Terry Alderman have? So, the only other thing I want to mention on this, there was a nice little discussion at the end of the highlights for the day's play from Richie Beno. And I just enjoyed his comment on Alan Border. It was like, every time I see him play, I enjoy his batting more. He doesn't look great, but he's a very good player. So, damning with faint praise there.
One for the purists, Richie is saying, isn't he? That's the subtext. Okay, are you ready for my next nomination, my second nomination?
Always ready.
Well, some ambiguity in this one. It's Brilly Parker or Parker Brilly is the heading I've put to this nomination. They always say never change a winning side, but England made three changes for this test. I think they've made changes every single test. Wayne Larkins was called up, Mike Hendrick was recalled, and Paul Parker came in for his one and only test. I was particularly struck that Larkins and Parker replaced Gooch and Gower, which feels very wrong with the benefit of hindsight, and very probably at the time as well. That's a real odd one, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very odd. I didn't even notice till you pointed it out that Gooch and Gower were missing. But it's very strange. I just kind of assumed they were there. They just weren't being shown on the highlights for some reason. But no.
I mean,
these two cricketers I've never heard of were in the team instead.
Yeah, Larkin's had a reasonable. Yeah, he played a few Test matches. He was pretty well regarded in county cricket. I don't know. Paul Parker's reputation that well. Obviously, he was good enough to play Test cricket, but he only played this one match. But you know, you're measuring that against Gooch and Gower, who are
yes.
just real contenders for all-time 11, I would imagine.
Well, both of them were England's top Test run scorer at one point or another, right?
Well, yeah.
So, yeah, reasonable players.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, right up there. In any case, in the first innings, Parker's the focus here. In the first innings, Parker came in at six behind Brearley, and I read in one report that Brearley had promoted himself to protect Parker. Brearley made a duck, and then three balls later, Parker made a duck. So that panned out incredibly well. But the only thing sort of like tempering that as a nomination is that Brearley's batting position was just all over the place in this series. He'd already batted at three and opened. And in the previous test, he'd swapped places with Mike Gatting for the second innings. And here he did the same, going in at six. So going in at five, Parker batted 46 balls for 13. And I'm now going to argue that in so doing, he protected Brearley, because Brearley pretty much saved the match coming in after him. Batting 2¾ hours for 51 and just sort of like riding out that final day. He almost did manage it. He inside edged his first ball right past his stumps to go for par. It was quite an exciting moment.
But after that, he was fine.
Yeah. So I don't really know the truth of the situation, because this was Parker's only test, so I don't know where he would have normally batted.
No one knows anything about Parker.
No, other than this sort of little snapshot.
He's a man of mystery.
If it's true that Brearley promoted himself to protect him that first innings, and then they both made ducks, that's just magnificent stuff. That's really like on a par with Bob Wilmer coming back in to resolve the number three problem and making a par. So that's really my nomination here.
On the face of it, I don't really buy this. I think this is just Brearley mucking about with the batting order because he can't think of anything else to do. I think he just gets bored in the dressing room when he can't do anything and it's too soon to declare. So I think he just mucks about with the batting order.
I think there is truth in that.
On the basis that it's very amusing, the idea that he promoted himself to protect Parker and then was out for a duck and then so was Parker, I'm going to assume that story is true, because it's always better to assume the more amusing option is true.
Yeah, that the level of protection provided by a three-ball dog.
My next nomination is Dennis Lilly's variable headwear. So this was when England's innings started, we got a glimpse of Dennis Lilly, and he had a headband on, as he so often did. This one was a spectacular orange/yellow. I'm not particularly great with colours. Nevertheless, whether it's orange or whether it's yellow, it was indeed very spectacular. It was just this, not quite fluorescent, but startling headband that he ran in and bowled with, and it was all very exciting. But that wasn't the only piece of trickery he used, because at one point we cut to him just yelling at the side screen to move, which in itself is slightly odd behaviour. I mean, usually that's left to the batter themselves or occasionally the umpire to go down and say, move that side screen or adjust that side screen or fix it or whatever is wrong. But the reason that Lilly was allowed to move it was because that he had borrowed Dickie Bird's hat to give him sufficient authority to get the side screen to move. So I'm not sure whether he stole it, whether he asked for it, but either way, he had Dickie Bird's hat on, which gave him enough gravitas, perhaps, to get the side screen moved on behalf of whoever wanted it moved, presumably the batter, but you never know with Dennis Lilly.
I wouldn't say it was a 100% convincing Dickie Bird disguise. I reckon I could have pegged that it wasn't Dickie Bird if I'd been sort of manning the side screen. So
possibly, but you know, you may have been distracted by tedious batting from Tavaray or Boycott and just been willing to accept any truth no matter how ludicrous it seems.
A bit of excitement. it's something to really raise the blood pressure. I can move the side screen. I'll get everyone moving. And the crowd are all in on it. Yes. Finally, yes. Some entertainment.
And speaking of entertainment, the final part of this nomination is that next time I see Dennis Lilly on the highlights, his headband is blue. And I assume that means he swapped headbands at some point. But again, going via the philosophy that it's always better to assume the more amusing option rather than the truth, there is a possibility that this is like this blue dress, gold dress thing of several years back, where it depends what angle you look at it from, whether he's actually actually wear a yellow headband or a blue headband. So I'm going to suggest that it's possible that he's got the same headband on, but it just looks a different... Maybe it's hypercolor.
And he'd heated up. He's deep into his spell and his head had warmed it into blue. Oh, you can tell Dennis Lilly's really on fire here. His headband's gone blue.
Yeah. So regardless of what the truth is, whether it's something as tedious as him just replacing the headband or whether it's massive fashion accessory, I'm going to nominate that. And just as kind of a general comment, I do feel, having watched this series, that Lily is even more underappreciated as a purveyor of nonsense than I previously realised, because I knew he had a few famous big moments, the aluminium bat and kicking Javed Miandad in the bum and asking the Queen for an autograph during the 1977 centenary test and so forth. But he's been a constant go-to in this series as well. He ate a banana, had people sing happy birthday to him. He's done all kinds of strange things. He got into fights with everybody at one point when he came out to bat. Yeah, I've really enjoyed all the little bits of Dennis Lilly nonsense. I think we must always treasure the great players who also turn out to be ridiculous. And Dennis Lilly, I think, qualifies as that. Much like Stuart Broad.
As I said earlier in the series, there was a moment where I was kind of watching him and he was just bowling and getting hit for fours and things. And it was kind of weird to me that it wasn't always these like high octane memorable moments, because that was previously all I'd ever seen. But similarly, it's not all the most famous, ridiculous moments. There is this kind of like undercurrent of, just sort of bubbling away, being a little bit silly.
Yes.
I mean, I haven't checked, but it feels like you've nominated Lily, if not every match, then most matches.
I think so. I nominated him three times in one test, but that was desperation stakes.
That might be shaping my perception a bit. He's certainly, I was going to say he's certainly a contender for ridiculous player of the series, but it's quite a strong field.
It is.
I'm about to move on to my next nomination here, which is beefy slow medium tenfer with bonus ricochet catching. I mean, we talk about this being both in Botham's ashes.
Yes.
But, there's like the real highlights of it, and then there's the bare figures of it. And then it's interesting to watch some of the sort of lesser known achievements or the sort of less scrutinized achievements. And I reckon this one, the tenfer in this final match, which, you know, didn't result in a victory, is striking and sort of adds to the legend. But the exact nature of it was quite interesting to see, because I don't know if Botham could have made it any clearer that he could do no wrong in this series, or at least the second part of it after he was he'd given up the captaincy. Because particularly in the later stages, it was like he was actively trying to play ineffectively, and it just didn't matter. He just still kept taking wickets no matter what he did. He took 6 for 125 in the first innings and then 4 for 128 in the second. So there was quite a lot of bowling. And what I would say is that the volume of bowling showed, and it's been a long series as well. One particular moment that stood out was towards the end of the first innings. He nearly bowled Mike Whitney with a bouncer.
And Willis was injured, right? So there was an injury, so he had to bowl more than his share?
Well, that was second innings. I think first innings was just a pretty long innings. Brearley was going a bit more towards the Kim Hughes school of not using too many of the bowlers. Second innings, I think Willis got through about 10 overs. What was it? He like pulled his tummy. I can't remember. He pulled his tummy muscles or something. They said.
Yeah, he had a tummy upset and a tummy muscle problem or something, I think. The commentator said.
In 1981, they didn't really blind you with science the way that they do these days, where you kind of have to be a physiologist to understand what they're talking about. You don't really, I don't know, they really dumbed it down for us. So he had a series of tummy injuries that prevented him bowling. So Beefy had to get through a few more overs. But before that, in the first innings, he took six wickets in the first innings, but he was actually involved in eight of the wickets, because there was fairly conventional catch, but then he also took a rebound catch off Tavares, who'd sort of spilled it, sort of facing backwards, facing towards the boundary. So that was another fine moment. Another standout was, I've forgotten who it dismissed, but there was like a wide, medium pace half volley, pretty much a full toss, that was for some reason edged to slip. And then he dismissed Kim Hughes' hit wicket, which is not really an accurate way of putting it, is it? Because I think it'd probably be more accurate to say he was the bowler when Kim Hughes hit his own wicket playing a pull shot.
Yeah, it was a big follow through from Kim Hughes, who decided he really wanted to pull it very hard to the boundary and just succeeded in knocking his stumps over. Just watching this as an Australian, I can't imagine how infuriating this would have been live. Like, I know the results of all these tests. I know Botham's just going to do nonsense. And it was still just like, why is he doing all? How is he doing all this? He gets both openers, takes a sharp slips catch to get the third wicket, and I'm just like, this is ridiculous. Then when Hughes is out, hit wicket. Like, he hits it, and then he basically runs two before he gets back the other end, and Botham's just pointing at the stumps and saying, "You're out." Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. It was Marsh who was caught by the rebound, and I was just at that point, I was just like, "Oh, for fuck's sake, this is ridiculous. This is genuinely ridiculous."
Sounds pretty like a compelling nomination already. If that's literally your reaction, is to use the word ridiculous.
Yes,
I imagine like watching his second innings wickets must have been maybe even more annoying because I think by that point he was bowling even slower. I was particularly struck by the delivery when he bowled Ray Bright. It was more his run up than the sort of action and the delivery himself, because I just didn't feel like he was going to make it to the crease. It was the most casual run up you'll ever see. He still sort of, I don't know, I guess maybe he was using his normal run up, but there was really no sort of sense of urgency to it at all.
I've often admired Cameron Green's run up. Cameron Green's got a very casual run up for a young man. I have previously said it's like the half-hearted jog you do when you're crossing, not at a pedestrian crossing, and you see a car. It's, all right, I have to just get to the other side, and you wave a hand up and say sorry about that.
Just three or four steps.
That's pretty much Cameron Green's run up, and Botham's was even slower somehow.
I remember Craig White as well. He was always famed for bowling pretty quickly, but really no run up at all. It was like he'd never bothered working it out, so he just kind of ambled in and whang. The thing it brought to my mind was many, many years ago when I used to use Graham Thorpe as a bowler in Brian Lara cricket on the PlayStation, because he used to waddle in and bowl this sort of like floaty medium pace with inexplicably massive swing. On computer games, if you're bowling a medium pacer, they always seem to swing it about 3 feet.
Yeah.
And that's basically what Botham was bowling in this test match, because he was swinging it. And I guess he just thought, well, at least I'm getting something out of through the air. I don't really need to bowl at anything approaching 75 miles an hour. I'll just amble in. So that was what it reminded me of. And then just as a final, very perfect example of the effort going in and just how inexplicably effective it proved. The ball that got Dirk Wellham LBW, I reckon it might have bounced a second time before it would have hit the stumps. It would have been an absolutely brilliant one to get Hawkeye on to see whether it was like within its scope of reasoning.
Yeah, send that one upstairs.
Yeah, so that was Beefy's 10th in this match. Just astonishing, but not really exactly the same kind of astonishing as the previous matches.
Yeah, just kind of willing wickets into... Well, not, he's not even trying hard. I can't say he's willing wickets into existence. They're just kind of happening around him.
There's just a gravity to him. Yeah, yes. It's just everything. Just wickets are being attracted. Just achievements are just being like drawn towards Beefy in this series by this point. In stark contrast to the first couple of tests when they were just, he was repelling.
Being repelled,
them.
Yes.
Someone had changed the magnetism on Beefy. Yeah.
Change the polarity on your Botham. Like, really?
That's all it took.
All right. Well, the wicket of Dirk Wellham kind of segues into my final nomination, because my nomination is the dashing debut of Dirk Wellham. Because in the mid-1990s, he was my go-to for funny, obscure cricket names. So if I wanted to amuse friends who, when I was talking about cricket, I would say Dirk Wellham as just a random generic cricketer. I think it was something about the strong K sound at the end of Dirk, and that combined with an unremarkable career, and no doubt the glasses as well. I think that combination just made him an amusing prospect for anybody who caught even a glimpse of his career.
I don't know if it's the same in Australia, but I don't know many other Dirks. That's another.
Oh, I know no other Dirks.
Yeah. No other. Well, I know. Well, I don't personally know, but I know Dirk Benedict, who played Face yes. in the 80s.
Yep.
You yep. would be the first Dirk who comes to mind for me from my childhood. Some great names of the actors in the A-Team incident. Anyway, and a second, and the only other one I can think of at the minute is Dirk Gently, who's a fictional character. He's the holistic detective in Douglas Adams' yes. books.
Two fine Dirks.
Two fine Dirks, yeah.
Yeah.
And I honestly can't think of another Dirk. Oh, wait, there was another. Oh, it was Dirk Nanison.
Yes, yes, of course, yeah. So there are a few other Dirks, but
a wealth of Dirks.
Dirk Wellham's always the first Dirk that will spring to mind, especially when it comes to cricket.
Top Dirk.
Top Dirk. He's anyway, he seemed very excited about being selected to play his first ever test. And at one point, the camera cuts him on the balcony and he gave this adorable little wave to the camera, which kind of struck me as very cute at the time. And then I realized that quite a few players were doing that. I don't know whether cameras cutting to the balcony were a new thing or whether they could just see themselves on the telly in the dressing room. I don't know why, but they all seem very pleased to just wave to the camera and go, oh, look, we're on the telly. You don't see that from modern players.
No.
Anyway, he made 112 ball 29 in the first innings, and that innings was ended by Willis, who just scattered his stumps everywhere. It was just a beautiful delivery, just an absolute mess of his stumps.
He didn't celebrate that enough, I thought. I mean, I know this is like part of Bob Willis's thing, that he, like, at best he does that sort of like little leap upwards, but
yeah,
it was one of those like bowlings, is that the word? It was yeah. one of those bolds where a bail just like exit shot. It's yes. flying so far, like it's gonna like hit someone in the eye in the crowd. Like yeah. as a fast bowler, it's just basically what you're trying to do. So to then do it and see it happen, I would be so uplifted by that. But Willis is just kind of like, yeah, I've just bowled him. Really underwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, all three stumps were pointed in different directions. That's always a good sign when they're geometrically alien to one another. Anyway, that wasn't the best part of Dirk Wellham's first test, though, because in the second innings, he came to the crease at 41 for 3, and he stuck around. He did not leave until 302 more runs had been added, and that was just before Stumps as Australia were about to declare. So he did his job, a great innings in the second innings, probably highlighted by when he was on 99, he hit a shot straight to mid-off, and in a crueler world, he would have and should have been caught, but that wasn't this world. The gods gave Dirk Wellham a break, and he was dropped at mid-off somehow and went on to make 100 on debut. And then something even worse than being caught on 99 happened to him, and that was small children all ran onto the ground to slap him on the back and say, well done, Dirk Wellham. And personally, I can't think of anything more aggravating than a small child slapping me on the back in congratulations. It's just like, go away. I do not want or need your approval. It feels so paternalistic to get a slap on the back, and I do not want it from a small child or indeed dozens of small children. So needless to say, Dirk Wellham got out almost immediately after those small children came on and slapped him on the back.
I mean, it's funny you say paternalistic, because watching the highlights, I felt paternalistic towards him, because he's the young lad early in his career, and you don't want things to go when he hits that ball to mid off. I'm kind of like heart in my mouth. I was just nervous for him, even though he's Australian.
You were one of those kids running onto the field, weren't you?
I was nervous for him, even though I knew he made it. Because, you know, just because he is a young lad on his debut, yeah. you just kind of, you were like after him. And then it occurred to me, this is a guy who's like 20 years older than me. It's like really weird dynamic.
Anyway, he got there. All is well for Dirk Wellham. So I think that's the end of our nominations, right?
Yep, that's three nominations each.
So what segment do we move on to next?
Well, we have discussed this, and I would like to rebrand the unnominated moments that we also want to mention section of the show as sundries.
Sundries.
I think that's a better branding. We were discussing debating extras and sundries just feels very exotic to me as a Briton.
It feels pretty exotic to me. It was used mostly in my childhood, I think. So it feels kind of nostalgic and nice. I can't think
of many other situations where the word sundries gets bandied about as a plural.
No, definitely not as a plural, yeah.
So we're adopting it, I think. Aren't we?
All right, so we have skillfully adopted a new title in the last episode of this series. great branding from us, as always.
And now the challenge is to remember that we've done this in time for whenever we get around to recording the next.
All right, you nominate us, Andrew.
It's not really ridiculous, but I wanted to, just because we're sort of rounding up the end of the series here, I wanted to highlight some of the bowling actions in this series, because there's some real corkers. There's Dennis Lilly's, obviously, is a sort of classic, and then Bob Willis is a sort of different kind of classic, particularly the run-up. But I was struck even by that one, because I didn't really realise how urgent his approach to the crease was. Willis really, really ran in and really gave it his all. It was really, you really felt like you were watching a proper test cricketer watching Bob Willis, which with a lot of sort of fast medium bowlers, particularly going back in time, you can tell they're the kind of stock bowlers, can't you? Willis just looked like the opening bowler. And then Whitney's got a good action too. He's a real sort of full-blooded Mike Whitney's
chest open. Yeah,
yeah, it gives it everything. But even John Enbury's, I thought, was quite striking, because he stretches backwards so far. It's like massive elastic chest thing. So his arms sort of not just back; it's almost sort of like doubling back on himself just before he's about to bowl. And then it's the kind of thing like not one. Like Jeff Thompson, but with none of the ramifications of that. It's just how he chose to bowl. And then of course earlier in this series we had Graham Dilley, which is probably the most idiosyncratic action of them all.
I think it was just an optical illusion, but it did look as if he just stopped at the very last step and then took the last step. I think that was just an optical illusion, but it did look very strange.
I think it's just waiting for his foot to come down. It just takes that long that you think, well, he's landed, now he's going to bowl, but to get his foot from way above his head down towards terra firma again took so long that really drew out that final little move.
Yes. Of course, none of those bowlers you've mentioned had an animated GIF made of their bowling action. So,
of course, the greatest of the lot. Ray Bright's sideways approach.
Yes. What a series it's been. I don't think we nominated at any point, but I think it was mentioned several times, always in the sundry section, and that was Kim Hughes's desperate aversion to a fifth bowler. But spoiler, big twist, plot twist in the sixth and final test. He found one. He found Graham Yallop, called upon him in the final day of the sixth test of a series, and maybe even the final session. It was very, very late.
I mean, it must have been.
Yeah. So that's good stuff.
I mean, did he only just realise that this was an option? Because
maybe.
So I went back and counted up, just because, I mean, it's pretty easy counting for the most part, but number of Australia bowlers used in each innings of this series: 4-3, 4-4, 3-4, 4-4, 4-4, 4-5. Just spoil it at the end.
That sounds like a strange piece of kind of arrhythmic music that just keeps changing time signature.
Yeah, maybe. they used six bowlers in total in the series, which meant that both Alderman and Lilly bowled over 300 overs each. And to provide a bit of context for that, the Aussie bowler with the heaviest workload in the 2023 Ashes was friend of the podcast Pat Cummins, who bowled 158 overs. Alderman bowled 325 overs. He bowled more than twice as many.
Twice as many, with one extra test, to be fair.
One extra test, yes, that is true. But I don't think he got through 160 overs in that test match.
No, not for lack of trying from Kim Hughes.
Kim, you're allowed to make bowling changes.
What else do we have?
Well, I've got one more, which was Mike Whitney going around the wicket.
Yes.
And so he signals his intent to do this. And Richie says, where's Whitney going to run when he goes around the wicket? Because he's really concerned that he's a young bowler. He probably hasn't bowled around the wicket very often. Where's Whitney going to run? He's going to run right down the middle of the pitch.
Yeah.
Because Richie called it. The neat thing was Richie said, well, I can't see how he's going to not run down the middle of the pitch. And sure enough, first ball, straight down the middle, gets a talkie to almost immediately by either Dickie Bird or Dennis Lilly in a hat. And it was very predictable and very funny.
Yeah, it was one of those where it's not like it's the first ball benefit of the doubt. It was just so blatantly, absolutely straight down the middle, like three footsteps that we just got to speak to him straight away, just as Richie predicted. And he's not the only one in this test, because I spotted both of them running down the middle of the pitch in the second innings, which didn't matter because England were batting last, I suppose. But he was really piling down the middle of the pitch. And even when he was out, he walked off down the middle of the pitch as well, which just seemed really gratuitous. And then, finally, when the match is over, the pompous PA fella warns everyone, stay away from the central area. And pretty much the entire crowd just completely fucking ignore him. And they swarm the wicket. It was like, again, I don't know, maybe it was the magnetism again, but it seemed like that was where everyone needed to be. And then the final point I wanted to make is that this was Mike Brearley's final test. When they interview him afterwards, he just said, so are you going to carry on? He's like, I think that's probably all right, isn't it? It just seemed like it was really unemotional.
Won the Ashes back.
Yeah, but it meant he finished undefeated as captain in 19 home test matches. And then I picked out his average in those test matches, his batting average, which was 21.65. And I've forgotten if that's more or less than Vernon Philander, which was my benchmark. It's really close.
That's very close. I don't remember either. That's a long way back now to when we first discussed that. But I do like that he decided he wasn't going to have more home tests than his batting average. So yeah. I think that's a good benchmark.
And I think odds are it probably would have crossed over in the next one.
Yes.
24.04. So... Yeah.
Doesn't pass the Vernon Philander threshold.
Doesn't pass the Vernon threshold.
How are we going to do this final test?
I'm not going to complicate this. I'm going to go with Beefy's slow medium.
Yeah.
To slow tenfer, which just shouldn't be a thing. And I don't know, given the fact it was Ian Botham in the 1981 Ashes delivering it as well, just seems to... really sort of underline it, italicize it.
As I said, the kind of visceral reaction watching it was like, this is ridiculous. How is he still getting wickets? How is he taking rebound catches? How is he making Kim Hughes hit his own stumps out of the ground? I don't understand any of this. How is he doing this? It's just mind-boggling. Because in my mind, I knew about like the two big ones. I knew about Headingley, obviously, and I was quite familiar with the fourth test as well, the 5-for-1. And I kind of just vaguely thought, well, he probably did a few other things. But he just kept going. The entire last four tests, he just kept doing ridiculous shit.
And yeah, in its own way, this was as ridiculous as anything else. Because it's Ian Botham just being unconcerned by circumstance.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the other matches, that's often the match situation.
Yeah.
And in this situation, it's his own ability. I mean, like, he certainly had an awful lot of ability, but in this match, he just had nothing left. I think he was just kind of like dead on his feet, really. But he wasn't going to let that stop him from taking a tenfer. He wasn't going to take the fact he was bowling like a club bowler, bowling loopy swing, stop him from taking 10 Australian wickets.
Yeah, yeah. I think the only contender I've got for that, and I'm not sure it's a real contender, but I am quite fond of Alan Border batting with a broken hand and still being by miles Australia's best batter. that's very amusing. That's kind of a good warm-up for the rest of the 1980s for Alan Border.
Like, yeah, really setting the scene.
No matter what happens, you're on your own, mate.
Yeah, they're certainly a powerful... I think in any other... not in any other test match. We've seen plenty of things, but in a lot of the other test matches we've covered, that would be the most ridiculous moment. But he's up against 1981 Beefy here.
1981 half-assed Beefy still basically winning a test by himself. Yeah, I guess the thing that most amazed me about Beefy's performance in this test was at some point I knew that this last test was a draw, And I just assumed that when England were five down for not many or six down for not many, I thought, oh, Beefy's going to come in and do something stupid again and get them to a draw that way. And I was very surprised when he didn't make any runs. And even more surprised when it was bloody Brearley saving the day. It's like, what the hell? This is nonsense.
Well, you see, Brearley had been offered that crucial protection by Paul Parker.
Yes. Yeah. So is Paul Parker, Brearley, your second best?
I don't know. What was the other one? I can't even remember.
The slow boycott Tavaray was also very good. I think you've got a few good ones in here. I think my second best is probably Dennis Lilly's mad headwear changes. But I think Beefy's definitely got the 3 points. I'm going to fight for Alan Border to get two, and then we can fight over the last one to see whether this is a draw or an England win.
Yeah, it felt a bit like you were acquiescing to one of mine. I'm not sure which one for the final point. I think Border, certainly twice as good as any of those remaining nominations, I would say.
Yeah.
Broken hand.
I think the boycott, I am quite amused by boycott at Tavaray just completely being booed by their home crowd and just still digging in, just like, we're going to do exactly what we want to do. And what we want to do is bat like the most boring bastards in the world.
I don't think like either of them was exactly the absolute most boring, but the fact that it was both of them coinciding, and then at a certain point they were clearly batting so boringly that nobody could bear it. Everyone was just, I wish the Lord would take me now.
Yeah.
And at that point their response was to carry on doing that. I think that's really the sort of nub of it for that nomination.
All right, let's give them the 1 point, which I think means England get the win in this final test, right?
Yes, and gives them a pretty dominant series result, 3-1 to England in the series as well.
Perfectly mirroring it, yeah.
The 1981 Ashes, I don't know how that went test for test, but I think as a series go, you know, sometimes we often say that sort of bad cricket is the more ridiculous. This must be like a fairly rare occasion where both of them in particular, the ridiculousness often coincided with good performances or good results in the case of this sixth test.
Yeah, I think we can safely say this is Botham's ridiculous Ashes, right?
Yeah, we'll give him that. Player of the series.
No, it's not Botham. It's definitely Botham's ridiculous Ashes. He can have true. Botham's Ashes, but this is Botham's ridiculous Ashes.
Botham's ridiculous Ashes.
Yes. All right, well, congratulations to Ian Botham and the rest of the England team. You are the holder of the 1981 Ridiculous Ashes. Hopefully Australia can strike back at some point in the future. We will find out when that is at some point when we next record. But until then, you should probably go check out Alex's website. That is over at kingcricket.co.uk. Mine is leibcricket.com, and you can find us on Twitter. We're at Ridiculous Ashes, at the King's Tweets, at leibcricket. Follow all three of us for maximum insight into what the hell we're talking about. I don't know. Follow all three of us to get a heads up on when we're going to come back. You'll triple your chances of spotting it. Or you could just subscribe to the podcast. And then whenever it comes, which could be any time between 6 and 18 months from now, it will drop instantly into your podcaster of choice. And so if you do that, then while you're doing that, subscribing, don't forget to give us your honest 5-star ratings on the podcast store of your choice. And thank you very much for listening to the 1981 Ridiculous Ashes. We will see you next time.
I think it's good to go out on a good, clear, coherent finish. Yes, we'll see you next time.
Bye. Well, now I'm gonna minimise any editing of that final bit there because I was just stumbling all over the place.
You're stumbling. You were just about holding it together. It was like a real tightrope walk, and occasionally you were just sort of getting distracted by something, some element that just struck you in the moment. I quite liked it.
All right. Well, I'm gonna cut this bit out and put it after the theme music at the end, just as an Easter egg for anybody who sticks through the theme music. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time. All right.
See ya.
All right. Now we've stopped recording. Oh. Sports Social
Podcast Network. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.